we're not saying stop development or pause it or whatever. We're just saying be smart, be secure, be safe, common sense safeguards.
Welcome to the Center for AI Policy podcast, where we zoom into the strategic landscape of AI and unpack its implications for U.S. policy. I'm your host, Jacob Krauss, and today's guest is Mark Beal. Mark is CEO and co-founder at Gladstone AI, and previously was Director of Strategy and Policy at the Department of Defense Joint AI Center. We cover the risk AI poses to U.S. national security and what the government should do about it. I hope you enjoy. Mark, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Jacob. Thanks for having me.
Great. I'm glad to have you here. Let's kick things off with what motivated you to start working in the AI space.
Well, great question, Jacob. So I guess my story begins, as I think like many of us, as a kid with an interest in physics and science fiction. I think I managed to read all the Star Trek books ever written by the time I was 13, and just was deeply obsessed with the science fiction arena and with computers and video games, and was kind of super into that stuff. In college, I did a little bit of stuff in the science and technology field, and then 9/11 happened, and I kind of diverted my career to doing a lot of national security work. But then, in a bit of serendipity, I was working for the 17th chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, on his action group, and I got a phone call asking me if I wanted to help stand up at DoD's Joint AI Center, and that's what really got me started in sort of professionally doing AI as a full-time job.
Wow. Yeah. And my understanding is you were somewhat involved in getting it set up. What was your role when you were working there?
So I was employee number 4 or something. My original role was data policy analyst. And I ended up kind of helping the organization in other ways and then ended up leading its strategy and policy directorate. And so we scaled that organization under the leadership of Lieutenant General Jack Shanahan, from like 4 or 5 guys in the back office in some Pentagon area to about 300 people with about $300 million in budget, trying to really accelerate the military services adoption of AI capabilities in support of everything from back office functions to the battlefield, as we used to say.
I wanted to circle into your work at Gladstone, which is where you currently are. You've sort of taken this original interest in AI and it's continued from there. Can you walk through what you're doing with Gladstone?
Yeah. So when I was in the Joint AI Center, one of the biggest and most strategic problems I noticed was this massive transom between policymakers and technologists, to the point where like we weren't even speaking the same language. And it's not that either person was stupid. It's just that like if you program in Silicon Valley speak into the DoD world, you just get syntax error and vice versa. So there's no real API, there's no real connection between these two organizations. And that resulted in some very bad outcomes for the government. Government was sort of insufficiently prepared to understand core inputs to AI and how to operationalize it responsibly. It was sort of left with a bit of information disparity between the developers and the buyers, so to speak, that created imbalances that we've kind of seen play out in a number of bad ways, especially when it comes to public policy. There's been some recent attention around Representative Beyer and his bill focused on AI risks, and he likened it to what happened with social media. When you have some tech executives who have sort of a monopoly of information about how this stuff actually works at a gears level, and then the people having to make decisions for the benefit of the public or for government functions and missions. And so Gladstone, at its first instance, set out to solve for that problem. We have a suite of training products that a lot of government leaders, including in defense, have leveraged to go from basically AI's foundations to its frontiers with no math and no code, high compression, a focus not just on the opportunities that the technology creates, but also on the risks, like very tactical risks around data security and privacy and cybersecurity, up to the more strategic risks associated with the weaponization of these tools and the loss of control of these tools and during the development phase. And so as Gladstone has kind of gone to market, we are actually the first company to build and deploy a large language model application to the federal government. We deployed an app powered by GPT-4 to the Air Force. This was in 2022 before the ChatGPT craze kind of hit the streets. And so we are very much pro acceleration, pro innovation, but doing so in ways that are sort of safe and effective and responsible.
Interesting framing around how there's two different cultures here. They have some ways that they can butt heads, but also some important synergies and finding ways to bring in the strengths of each one. So can we get into now some of the AI meat and potatoes, the stuff you think about a lot? What are some of the, you mentioned cybersecurity risks that AI could pose? Let's start with AI and cyber offense, cyber defense. What's its role there?
Yeah, so AI and cyber is a risk class that we incurred 3 years ago that no one really has recognized yet. And at the end of the day, if you have a system that in natural language can write human competitive code, it can write competitive malware. And so if you think about the context of like open sourcing high-end capabilities, model weights and all, that can be used to generate interesting and cool programs, web applications, websites, and so forth, well, those tools can also be used to create malware. So if you want to ask, like, from the open source, like, what's the most powerful, what is, like, the Iranian or the North Korean, you know, AI cyber weapons program look like, you need look not further than what's available in the open source today. And so with very limited cost, an actor can download these model weights and even do some fine tuning on specific examples of previous uses of malware. And now they have a cyber operations tool or a spear phishing campaign tool that can be used at scale to wage cyber attacks on U.S. infrastructure. And this is a serious problem. And so you could have like the black bot and the white bot kind of battling each other out. But at the same time, that's a recipe for always being behind and always losing. I think there's a different type of policy set of tools that will be exposed to people once they start to dive into the technology and how it actually works.
Yeah. Are there some policy recommendations relating to cyber that you'd like to see, or potentially technological safeguards you'd like to see, or usage restrictions? How would you want people to navigate cyber?
Yeah, I think the most important, and this is controversial, but the most important and critical near-term step government needs to make is banning the open source publication of AI model weights trained above a certain threshold of compute. So we look to examples like the executive order that says, reporting for models, plan training runs above a certain number, 10 to the 26 flops. And people are like, well, why would you use that weird number to come up with a metric? But the reality is because AI is more like alchemy than it is like science, we're left with a set of tools that are focused on the inputs. And so the inputs in this case are the hardware inputs that go into software breakthroughs, because unfortunately there is a one-to-one mapping between a semiconductor breakthrough and an AI model. Just take, for example, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Center. It creates a 7-nanometer resolution chip that leads to an NVIDIA A100 GPU that leads directly to GPT-4. Or take, for example, the TSMC 5-nanometer chip that leads to the H100 from NVIDIA that leads to the training run on GPT-5. So there's a direct mapping from hardware to software. And when that software gets created and all those hundreds of millions are spent to create the system, those weights that are produced, if they're then published in the open source, that's a recipe for it's very dangerous. And existing authorities in the government, especially the Department of Commerce, give the government the tools to be able to do this quite easily. Now, there are a lot of people, for example, from Meta and from Hugging Face, who would resist this idea. They say that open source is great for the culture. It's accelerating development. It's accelerating the free flow exchange of ideas. And I think that's also true. I just think that when you cross a certain compute threshold and these applications start to resemble more like proto WMDs, maybe we should not publish the blueprints for these things online.
Mm. It's made headlines just last week with Zuckerberg for talking about Facebook. They bought hundreds of thousands of AI chips, and I believe that would cost them billions of dollars since the chips are about 10,000 a piece. And they're planning to use this to build full general intelligence, was the words he used. And they say they want to open source this as responsibly as they can. What are these big concerns you would have if they open source that level of model?
Yeah, I guess in general, when I think about AI and national security risks, I used to work for Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, and he would always say, define the problem to a Jesuit's level of satisfaction. And I hear a whole lot of talk in places like Capitol Hill and in government agencies about AI risks broadly. But one risk is not the same as the other. And I think it's really important for policymakers to understand issues around AI that are, you know, biased data sets leading to discriminatory outputs and disadvantage. That's kind of one category. There's business and cyber defense and criminal stuff. That's another category. And then there maybe is a third category of national security risks. And I would say the free market is going to solve for the vast preponderance of those risks. But for those risk classes that are specialized and more national security-like, because the systems implicated are, like, you could imagine, these systems need like their own nuclear reactor to create. Like, these are massive, expensive, highly capable systems. There is where government oversight and regulation is going to be required. Not for the vast majority of AI issues, but for those national security risks. And I decompose those national security risks into two basic vectors. The first vector is around weaponization. So that is, how can a threat actor take an AI tool and use it to inflict cost damage on the United States, our people, our interests? And here, you know, we have questions around the WMD sort of enablement activities. So especially in the open source, if China, DPRK, others can kind of harvest these models and then use them for nefarious purpose, that is a real threat of weaponization. And the sad part is that those threats are coming from the United States. We are arming our adversaries in some very real sense and building the arsenal of China's AI weaponry. And I wonder when that should stop. And I think it should have stopped about a year ago, but for some reason that continues. Then there's this other category of threat. So we have weaponization, and then we have this other category of threat around this idea of loss of control. And you hear a lot of people talking about these issues, and a lot of people will sort of scoff and say, oh, it's about Terminator. But actually, I think this is a real threat, and it's grounded in facts that are observable, at least empirically, and we can measure. And so today, because AI, again, is more like alchemy than it is like science, nobody can really assure that these systems won't pursue strategies that we find that don't cause massive amounts of collateral damage in their pursuit of that optimized objective. I think this is a very real risk class. And you hear guys like, you know, the Anthropic team and Google and Microsoft and OpenAI in making massive investments and alignment to try to solve for this problem, because I believe they see this issue as a fundamental step to solve for prior to reaping the benefits of a human level AGI or even a super intelligent system, which I believe is certainly on the horizon.
Thanks for that. I'll dig more into that. First, you use this phrase, AI is more like alchemy than it is like science. Can you unpack that for the audience?
Sure. What ends up happening, let's think about our own brains. And because these systems, neural networks, very much draw inspiration from our own brains. And as you can imagine, our brain is a bunch of these cells called neurons. And these cells and the connections between them in some very meaningful way encode who we are as a person and what we've learned about the world. And as we go in the world, maybe we experience a hard trauma, or we get we learn a new task or a new skill. We can imagine the strength between those neurons. They get adjusted in real time. And in a very similar way, we have artificial neurons and artificial substrates. And you can think about even measuring the strength of those connections by placing a number between them. So you can imagine neuron A and neuron B, there's a strength of 9. That suggests maybe that's a stronger connection. And then neuron A to neuron C, well, maybe that's a 4, so that's a weaker connection. And then, so what happens as you train these huge models, you take this task that seems very boring and mundane called text autocomplete, and you can sort of force your way to a robust world model. Because what ends up happening, if you're going to predict the next word in a sentence very accurately, imagine you want to predict, in order to counter rising China, the United States should blank. If you're going to predict that next word, you have to have some fundamental understanding about what China is, about what the United States is, about what competition and geopolitics and economics and military strategy, all of these latent issues. Well, in some very real sense, that information gets encoded in the strength of the numbers between artificial neurons. And that's called parameters. And so at the end of the day, what you actually have in terms of like GPT-4, we think is about 1.6 trillion fractional numbers. And so you feed it input into this gigantic array of fractional numbers, and then there's an output that's magical on the outside. So, but what happens in that box? You can't, there's no scientific theory. There's no E equals MC squared equation that explains that. All we have is empirical evidence that it's working. So when I say AI is like alchemy, we have no real way to understand what's actually happening, the magical special sauce, other than the brute force training using hundreds of millions of dollars of compute and sophisticated algorithms to make that autocomplete text accuracy number go up as high as possible. And this has very real implications for, you know, policy approaches, because if you're going to build stuff that you don't in the first instance understand how it works, and at the same time you're saying it could create catastrophic effects on humanity itself, that should be a gigantic red flag for anyone who's intellectually curious in Congress.
Mm. Right. The black box nature of training, and in some ways the whole paradigm of machine learning, is saying instead of humans writing programs to do a task, we have humans writing programs to find another program to do a task. And that new program that we get is not interpretable to us. I'd love to get into more on this AI loss of control threat and weaponization threat. What are some particular, for the weaponization one, what are some particular weapons of mass destruction or AI-related weapons developments that you are concerned about?
So imagine you're U.S. Indo-PACOM, and you want to field a counter-UAS system, counter-unmanned aerial vehicle system at the edge of your formation to defend against drone swarms. And you spend 5 years and $1 billion building this system, then you deploy it in the field. And then China has 100 sort of cheap drones controlled by an AI-enabled brain that has been trained with this few-shot reinforcement learning model. Well, what that means is those drones can now kind of go over to you and interrogate you and interact with your capability and learn very quickly how that, like, what's the right angle to attack to defeat that system. And now within a few hours, what took you 5 years to build has been made obsolete. And so this is the reality of where the U.S. military finds itself today. And this revolution of military affairs, instead of happening in cycle times of 10 years or more, they're now happening in a matter of hours. So this is a fundamental challenge to our acquisition of capabilities, to our tactics, techniques, training procedures, and a whole host of kind of upstream military types of activities that will affect future battlefield success. And this is something that I'm not quite sure Congress and DOD has yet internalized. And then, you know, we have another basket of more specific things around lethal autonomous weapons. And, you know, here is, I think this is the danger here is that AI technology, safety and control right now are major bottlenecks to our ability to control and assure these systems. And so people may not, especially in Silicon Valley, might not realize, but the military has a very robust culture of safety. You can look at like examples from like the nuclear Navy and how that led the way about how to harness nuclear power for civilian applications, or the Air Force and Air Army Corps for aviation safety. I think in a similar way, the military is going to be faced with a threat of adversaries' deployment of lethal autonomous systems that are inherently dangerous and can't be controlled, versus now the question is, what are we going to do about it? So I think the first thing the U.S. military needs to do about it is build out those safety and control mechanisms and actually assure these systems. The rush to field a symmetric capability with another lethal autonomous weapon that you know is not going to be safe is the wrong strategy. Maybe instead you take you take the strategy of fielding some asymmetric capability that can target an enemy's AI system and make it do funny things like attack its own forces or so forth. And I think this is a very important point, that safety and control are fundamental bottlenecks to safe deployment of lethal autonomous weapons. And until that is going to be solved for, the U.S. military, by its own policy, is not going to be fielding those types of weapons. However, it doesn't mean our enemies won't try. I think that's another kind of basket of more specific kind of of issues when it comes to weaponization. We've talked a lot about the cyber and manipulation type things. So, you know, when you think about a spear phishing campaign, what AI has done for us is it's reduced the trade-off between quality and quantity. So in other words, if I were a spear phisher and I wanted to target some congressman or some general, I would need to spend some time doing research, figure out who this guy was, crafting just the perfect email that spoke to him in this very specific way and hit send. Or alternatively, I could take the approach of I'm going to blast 10 million emails of the same kind of low quality content and hope that one schmuck clicks on the link. But what AI has done is enabled us to remove that trade-off. Now we can get both the highly tailored, high quality content at the tens of millions of person scale with one click of a button. So I can tell you that like the presidential election in 2024 is going to be rife with AI powered deepfakes, misinformation, disinformation. A lot of that's going to be coming internally, and it's not really appropriate for the U.S. government necessarily to police the First Amendment and free speech. However, it's going to be complicated when foreign actors are trying to meddle in our election and are using AI tools to do so. I think this is a very real threat. And the government, candidly, is quite behind on, in my understanding, with the defenses for how that's going to look. So I guess in sum, yeah, this sort of strategic move, counter move on in military dynamics could be potentially very destabilizing. The lethal autonomous weapons question and the safety and control bottlenecks, and then the cyber and disinformation campaign tools that are now available are some of the things I worry most about from a weaponization perspective.
Fascinating. And you keep referencing about how the government will need to deal with some of this, sort of obviously, because these seem like pretty big threats. What would you actually want the government to be doing to address this? What are some of your big asks?
Yeah, I think right now there's a lot of narrative that's making the government feel like it has a false choice between innovation and security. I think that the first thing that policymakers need to do is reject that. It's not true. I think if you define the problem really, really well, and you focus the government action on those high-end national security threats, and you let free market solve for basically everything else, you have the formula for a very effective pro-innovation and pro-security AI strategy that was going to help unlock a very robust industrial capacity here in the United States, and also provide for the common defense, which is a core function in our Constitution. And so in terms of what specifically I would like to see government do in the near term, and I think the first and most important thing is to lock down that supply chain, is to curb technical collaborations between U.S. technology companies and Chinese and adversarial counterparts, and impose additional export controls, not just on supply chain models, or not just on the AI models themselves, but the hardware and data centers and talent upstream of creating those AI models. This is very, very, very important. And that's going to address a big chunk of the weaponization threats in the near term. Now, these aren't easy tasks, but they're very doable within existing authorities, and it's just a political will, a choice to do so. The second basket of risks, as we've talked about, you know, national security-wise, this alignment risk, this is a little more complicated. And unfortunately, it's going to require a whole lot of intellectual curiosity from members of Congress and from the executive branch to lean into these kinds of threats. But I would argue that when you scale an AI system that creates WMD-like effects potentially, and you don't really understand how those systems work, that screams this idea that you need common sense safeguards around that activity. So again, you can imagine snapping a chalk line at a certain level of compute the White House has used 10 to the 26 flops. That's a good as number as any for now. But you could imagine a series of safeguards that get locked in place when you go above that number. And you know, imposing that on industry is a hard and fast requirement. I don't think this is a trust but verify situation, because many of these labs are asking the public to incur significant potential risks and just saying, just trust us, it'll be fine. I don't think that's right. I think the government has a constitutional mandate to intervene and to put safeguards, common sense safeguards, in place around these labs as they scale. And again, that's not going to touch 99% of the industry. We're talking about only those training runs that cost $1 billion or more. So these are like very small subset of actors that would be affected. And we want to harness all of that goodness that comes out of that. We just need some safeguards to make sure that things don't go off the rails and there's contingency plans in place. And if they do, and I think many of these actors at the labs are acting in good faith. I think many of them are being subjected to a race dynamic in which they're almost at a loss for their own agency. And I think government intervention at this particular moment in history, I think, would be welcomed by many of these frontier labs. I know that's a controversial thing to say, but I stand by it. I think putting some common sense safeguards in place and then locking down the supply chain and preventing our adversaries from weaponizing this stuff against us, to me, seem like some of the most common sense things. And I'm kindly questioning why this actually hasn't happened yet.
Those are good. There's been a little bit of work I've seen on the hardware stuff where we're trying to get these export controls in place on chips going to China. But from my understanding, it's quite hard to enforce. The relevant agencies doing it are pretty underfunded. That's the Bureau of Industry and Security in the Department of Commerce. And we've also got some agencies being tasked with doing AI safety related stuff, like the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, has a bunch of tasks relating to red teaming, and another agency within commerce is looking at the risks of open source models. And I think overall, what I've heard in NIST, for example, is they're quite underfunded. So there's potentially just an appropriation cycle, some work to be done there. On the what you mentioned, cost of compliance, I agree that this seems like in some cases, companies like OpenAI are going and actually asking for this. It in some ways, leveling this playing field will ensure that everyone's using the appropriate safety minimums, and it's going to constitute a small fraction of that 100 million plus cost for current models, and maybe billions or more in the near term future. So I'm definitely keen on that. Now, what do you think if we don't put these safeguards in place? What is a concrete scenario you're worried about happening? Why do we need this?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And I'm glad you flagged all of the work that the U.S. government is doing today. I think it's a good step, but it's just too little too late at this stage. And I don't think more money to the federal government is going to solve for this problem. I think we need policymakers to understand the technical details of what's happening today. And that we need to ask, when industry is asking the public to incur significant risk on its behalf, the government needs to ask industry to take these prudent and common sense safeguards. And it's not just about safety, it's about security. You know, you can imagine if you're a Chinese, intelligence actor, Google DeepMind is going to be one of your number one targets. And are they capable of withstanding the onslaught of a well-resourced nation-state espionage campaign? I don't know, but I know the government can probably help a lot in those areas. And so easy low-hanging fruit steps like designating those labs as critical infrastructure under Presidential Policy Directive 21 begins to unlock a whole lot of interesting industry government collaborations that don't come with a gigantic resource bill and more people and humans in seats doing jobs. That's just going to cost the taxpayer more and drive the budget up. I think instead asking industry to kind of do its part is a very, and again, we're not asking for crazy stuff. We're not saying stop development or pause it or whatever. We're just saying be smart, be secure, be safe, common sense safeguards. And I think this is very, very kind of an important dimension to the problem. I think another kind of risk of what's going on right now is there's, if you look at the executive order, especially, it's 118 pages released in the last year of administration. And it's quite unfocused. And so I think the administration was trying to do its best to give something to everybody. But when you rack and stack these threats, one type of threat is very different from another type of threat. And I know prioritization is really hard, but it's necessary. And I think, focusing government action on those high-end threats in the first instance is like a very, very important thing, the most important thing to do. And this comes with potentially a reprioritization within existing department agencies' budgets. And no department, I work in government, nobody wants to reprioritize or reprogram their funding. Everyone's got their projects. But I think at this moment in history, the United States government is facing its most important test of technology governance ever, and it's failing, and it needs to stop failing.
This has been enjoyable episode for me, to hear all of your insights and and the passion you have for the subject and some of the really urgent actions that need to be taken, some of the very pressing threats coming up on the horizon. I think before we close, do you have stuff, any last things you wanted to share with the audience and anything you wish I had asked you?
No, this is a great discussion. I am very passionate and I will continue to be so in 2024. We're going to be getting organized and getting the message out about these common sense safeguards and supply chain controls that can be done in the near term. I would just conclude with a little bit of discussion back from American history. So I'll share my favorite president in history is this little known guy named John Quincy Adams. He was a one-term president, and he was sort of notorious. He helped stand up the National Institutes for Sciences, and he was known to be kind of a guy who bucked his own party and a free thinker, very heterodox thinker when it comes to, like, you know, issues. And what struck me about him was just how intellectually curious he was. So I think for today's policymakers, being intellectually curious, having some intellectual humility, and being willing to dive into the technical details beneath the memes, this is like a very fundamental thing for our friends in government to kind of get after. Because I do believe that right now big tech is driving the train. All the venture capitalists are screaming about people will die if you don't accelerate. But they're framing this as like a false choice between reaping the benefits and managing the risks. I think the risks are very real. I think they can be very easy. They can be very well managed, and they can be managed in such a way that we can actually reap the benefits without slowing people down. And this is a sweet spot that can be worked on once you start to unpack and double click through the memes and get down into the brass tacks. So intellectual curiosity, intellectual humility, these are traits that I think are deficient right now in Washington. And I think they're going to be necessary for us to come together as civil society and solve for these problems.
That's a very nice way to put it. I totally am on board with open-mindedness and people learning and trying to never settle into a particular dogma or thinking, okay, I'm in this tribe now. I'm seeing increases in tribalism in AI, which is kind of upsetting for me. So thank you for that. Now, is there anywhere the audience should look if they want to learn more about Gladstone, if they want to keep in touch with you, stay up with your work?
Yeah, feel free to visit us on our website, www.gladstone.ai. Hello@gladstone.ai. You'll get a hold of us, and we'd love to chat further with you. We are a commercial company, and we have taken no venture capital, no effective altruism money, so we consider ourselves to be very independent. And we're very patriotic and have a sense of duty to the American public. And that's what motivates us every day to keep on the good fight. And yeah, reach out anytime.
Amazing. My guest today has been Mark Beal. Mark, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Center for AI Policy Substack for a transcript, links, and more. And if you have feedback for the show, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at jakub@aipolicy.us. And looking ahead, next episode will feature Daniel Coulson discussing U.S. public opinion on AI. I hope to see you there.